Hi, it's Diane. On my mind, the past, present, and future of Title IX. June marks the 50th anniversary of the landmark gender equality law, which bans sex discrimination in education. Though the effects of Title IX have been far-reaching, one of the more visible areas of impact has been in the realm of sports. The legislation vastly expanded opportunity for girls and women to participate in athletics at every level of their scholastic careers. But many say there's still much work to be done on the issues of compliance, financial support, and protections for trans athletes. My guest today is Elizabeth Sharrow. She's a scholar of sex and gender in American politics and an expert on the history and consequences of Title IX. Professor Sharrow, first, can you clarify for us what Title IX is and what it covers?
So Title IX is, I think it's important for folks to understand that this is a civil rights policy that was passed now nearly 50 years ago in 1972. And it was modeled after elements of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. And it actually states, in effect, that no person in the United States shall, on the basis of sex, be excluded from participation in, be denied the benefits of, or be subjected to discrimination under any education program or activity receiving federal financial assistance. So this is a federal policy designed to, and that applies to all levels of education, designed to address sex-based discrimination in education.
What about the roots of the law and why it was passed in the first place?
Well, you know, we have to think back to how the world was different in so many ways a half century ago. But among the things that that were on the mind of feminist activists in the late 1960s and in the early 1970s were questions about the nature of sexism and things that we didn't yet have words for, but that we now call sex discrimination in education. And so there were a number of lawmakers and also activists outside of Congress who had experienced various forms of exclusion from education, who had been, for example, able to obtain a bachelor's degree, but and had intended to go on to become a doctor or a lawyer, but were excluded from and told that they actually were not allowed to get those degrees for reasons as simple as the fact that there were few women who should be given those opportunities. And activists started saying, you know, these are major problems, not just for education, but for all of the long-term effects that education confers on individuals who get advanced degrees. And so it isn't just about getting a law degree, it's about being a lawyer and having the kinds of salary and long-term status that came with those degrees. And so activists started to research what was really going on in higher education and started to demonstrate, right, that these weren't just one-off decisions in admissions. These were systematic exclusions that women were confronting in education, and that it was happening in undergraduate degrees, in graduate degrees, in faculty appointments, and that was really changing the face of American education. And so lawmakers, again, having recently experienced the ways in which federal law had been crafted to address race-based discrimination after the Black Civil Rights Movement and in the context of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, looked to that law to create a new model and brought these ideas to Congress, right, and said to each other in the halls of Congress and then eventually to the American people, there are ways that we can name these problems as concerns for all Americans and also to address them through federal law.
One of the areas that Title IX has had the biggest impact is on sports. Talk about the landscape for women in sports prior to 1972.
Yeah, this is a great question. One of the things that is also important to know about Title IX is that although it has had dramatic impacts in athletics, athletics actually weren't the dominant target for lawmakers at the time, right? They were thinking about these educational opportunity exclusions. But as soon as the law was passed and policymakers had to decide how to implement it, how to give meaning to this relatively short piece of legislation, it became very clear that the conditions of athletic opportunities for girls and women in the U.S. Were very imbalanced. Only about 7% of high school girls had participation opportunities at the high school level. And at the college level, those exclusions were similarly stark, right? Sports were really understood at the time as a domain that was largely reserved for American boys and men. And there was quite a bit of contention over whether or not a federal policy designed to address educational discrimination should apply to athletics. But we have to remember that the American system of education is this peculiar model, especially if we look to how other countries address these things. And we do fold in school-sponsored sports in the host of educational opportunities for American children. And so the way that the law was written became very clear over the course of the 1970s that because sports are an educational programming, they also applied under Title IX. And the impact of implementation of educational and athletic equity over time under Title IX has dramatically changed those opportunities for girls and women.
But how long did it take for schools to comply with Title IX?
Well, that's a very uneven story. You know, whereas I mentioned that in the early 1970s, only about 7% of high school athletic opportunities were available to girls. Now it's about 43%. Nearly half of American girls participate in high school sports of one kind or another. But that has been a very uneven path, right? Because the law was very contentious in its implementation, and also because the federal government has been slow to fully enforce the law, schools have had to make a set of decisions under some conditions of uncertainty. And especially in the 70s and the 80s and into the early 90s, it was very unclear how serious the federal government was going to be about enforcing the law. So there was, you know, many schools came to understand that there were obligations under Title IX, you know, by the mid-1970s. So much public attention had been devoted to the law. Sports were really central to those conversations by that time. And many institutions started to expand their sports teams and their offerings at both the high school and the college level. But even to this day, right, those choices that schools and colleges and universities have made have not gotten us to the point of full parity for in athletic opportunities for girls and women. Still to this day, only 44% of collegiate athletic opportunities, for example, are given to women in American colleges and universities. And so we are still short of full equality under Title IX, and that's related to the ways in which it has not been fully enforced.
I gather that your interest in Title IX has roots in your own experience.
Yes, that's exactly right. I was very fortunate to be an undergraduate at the University of Minnesota and had joined a club rowing program my first year of college. And at the end of that year, the university made the announcement that they were adding a varsity level women's rowing program to their intercollegiate varsity sports offerings. And so I stayed with the team and competed on a varsity level sport for the rest of my collegiate career. And the university at the time, you know, said, we're doing this because of Title IX. And so it was also a real moment of political awakening for me to understand that these changes in what have come to be real changes in the course of my life were due very much to policy implementation. And I stayed on to coach with the team for 5 years before I went on to graduate school and have now pursued a long-term research agenda on these issues. But I have always been interested and captivated by the meaning of policy implementation in my own life, but increasingly as a social scientist in the lives of American girls and women more generally.
So all in all, how successful would you regard Title IX to be?
You know, I love this question, and I think it is the question that we are going to be thinking about in over the summer of 2022, because this summer is the 50th anniversary of the passage of policy. And the way that I think about answering that is a sort of critical celebration. You know, I think that we as Americans should think about Title IX as having had widespread and critically important impacts in changing higher education for American girls and women, or for women in higher education, right? As excluded as women were in the early 1970s from medical and law schools, right? Only about 2% of those educational opportunities were available to girls and women in 1970. Now about 50% of medical and law degrees are conferred to women. So there is an important and dramatic story of social and educational change that has been brought about by policy implementation in education and in sports. At the same time, these opportunities have not necessarily been available to all women equally, right? Title IX says that sex discrimination is illegal. And yet at the same time, it says nothing about race-based discrimination. And the reality is that when you start to peel back the layers of Title IX's impacts in education and in sports, those opportunities have been disproportionately available to white women, to upper to middle class white women. And so I think we have to be mindful of who that that celebratory narrative applies to and who it doesn't. And so the race-based story is certainly one of the major complications of this, but it's not the only one. We're having much more complicated conversations over what sex discrimination should mean if we take it seriously across the board. So Title IX has also become central to conversations about sexual harassment and sexual violence on college campuses, on issues of gender identity and trans inclusion in college sports as well. And so the future of Title IX is, I think, really going to be determined by how well we can handle those conversations and how seriously the federal government takes the question of fully enforcing the law. Because the third dimension that I think folks should think about when they think about the history of Title IX is that, on the one hand, it's made some significant changes to participation opportunities. On the other hand, the funding imbalances, which Title IX does not speak to, are dramatic, right? The vast majority of funding dollars at the college level continue to be spent on men's sports, continue to fund men's opportunities, men's coaching salaries, and there are major imbalances that we don't have a policy solution to address per se. And so the quality of those opportunities should be front of mind as Americans think about the meaning of Title IX.
Now a quick break. When we return, the rest of my conversation with Elizabeth Sharrow.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily. Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
And we're back. Here's the rest of my conversation with Elizabeth Sharrow. She's professor of history and public policy at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. What about trans women in athletics and Title IX's impact on them?
So the questions around trans inclusion, I think the way to think about these are to remember where I started, which was to recall that Title IX is a civil rights policy, right, that says that inclusion of students in education cannot be contingent on their sex-based identity. And increasingly, right, we're having a more nuanced conversation about gender identity as well. And the policy environment of this, the policy environment of Title IX has really been defined by lawmakers trying to figure out what sex discrimination is. But in recent years, we have seen courts and policymakers start to define that in terms of its relationship to gender identity. And these rulings and policy decisions indicate that gender identity-based discrimination is indeed a form of sex discrimination, and that gender identity discrimination for trans athletes, we have, I think, a more robust legal understanding now that trans students cannot be denied access to classrooms and also to restrooms at school on the basis of their gender identity. And the conversations around athletics have to hew towards similar understandings, right? We can't include trans kids on the debate team or the math club, but exclude them from sports teams, right? Civil rights policy doesn't make those kinds of nuanced designations. And indeed, the benefits of athletics for all kids, right, are really dramatic. And I think the purpose of civil rights policy protections are to ensure that all kids have access to those things.
But at the same time, you've got some governors laying down laws in individual states saying it's not going to happen here. How does Title IX step in? Does each of these questions go to the Supreme Court?
Well, this also comes back to remembering that Title IX is a piece of federal policy. And so it applies in all states in similar ways. Now, what we're watching and what we're seeing unfold is a contest over federalism. So you have lawmakers in some states, and indeed 14 states so far have passed bans on trans athletic participation. These are dominantly focused on trans kids who are competing in school-sponsored sports in junior highs and in high schools. We are also in the process of watching those laws being contested under federal law. And so though those laws may stand right now, the courts are really going to be, have already been drawn into the mix to adjudicate the meanings of Title IX. And in order to understand where I think that's headed, you know, we can look to how the courts have decided other gender identity discrimination cases. And I'm thinking here of the Bostock v. Clayton County case that was decided just a couple of summers ago, which was a question of whether or not trans people are protected from workplace discrimination on the basis of their gender identity under elements of the civil rights law of 1964. And the courts in that case interpreted gender identity-based discrimination to be a form of sex discrimination. And I think we're very unlikely to see the court apply that ruling at work, but walk it back at school. And so I think we are in a treacherous period where the stakes are very high for trans athletes at the high school level in these states where exclusions are being passed, but also for trans kids and trans adults nationwide who are being exposed to forms of discrimination and animus that suggest that trans people are less than human, right? And that we know that most fully in the realm of sports. These are extremely powerful and damaging conversations that are happening as the courts work out the legal questions of how Title IX will apply and whether or not these state laws can stand. So I'm hopeful that in the long run, there will be ways for the courts to strike down those state laws. But in the meantime, I'm very concerned about the kinds of damage being done but for trans kids, but also for all of our conversations about the
exactly.
nature of gender equality.
It was a piece on NPR the other day where a mother spoke about her trans child, whom she totally accepted, but they were moving out of their state because the governor of that state had ruled that no trans person could participate in high school sports. So where does Title IX come in there? I mean, she has to pick up and move her entire life to go to a school in another state where she will be allowed to participate and not be shamed because she is trans.
Yeah, you know, I think that as much as I've talked about the courts and as much as Title IX is about policymakers, some of this is going to come down to how the American public responds to these types of laws, to the discourse that's embedded within them. And I think it's worth noting, right, that this isn't just about sports. You also have lawmakers passing laws that try to regulate the access of trans kids to medical care. And in some states, there are lawmakers trying to suggest that adults also shouldn't have access to gender-affirming care. And so sports is only one dimension of this broader conversation. And actually, in some ways, right, sports have come on the heels of other anti-trans lawmaking efforts in terms of trying to deny trans people access to public restrooms, to public accommodations more generally. And I think that the courts are important actors in this, but so too are American citizens who need to see the destructive ideas that are embedded in these laws, that if trans kids are not allowed to declare openly and to live the full truth of who they are, that will have negative impacts for cisgender folks who identify with the sex that they were assigned at birth as well. And that these laws that target trans kids are actually more profoundly interested in targeting anybody who is gender transgressive. So even girls who were assigned female at birth, who identify as girls, but whose gender presentation may defy conventional understandings, can actually be targeted by these laws and can be targeted by, say, parents on the sidelines who say, I don't know if that kid is really a girl. Does she belong on this team? The destructive ideologies that are embedded in that form of gender policing and that are authorized under these laws have the capacity to take us back to very dark places, which I think many Americans imagine that we have evolved beyond. So Americans also need to take this charge seriously, to contact their lawmakers and to mobilize in lots of ways in support of trans kids, because this is about all of us and our abilities to live fully and wholly in a society that is continuing to evolve on gendered dimensions.
But what about the argument that a boy who is trans playing on a women's team or a girl's team has an unfair advantage because of muscular ability that perhaps girls don't have? How do you respond to that?
So there is far more that we don't know about the relationship between gender transition, bodily traits, and sex than there is that we do know. That is to say, there's very little research on the relationship between transness and athletic capacity. And indeed, the notion that the mere sex category assigned at birth confers some form of advantage especially for those who were assigned male, who may have spent part of their lives being socialized as a boy, but who have now come out as trans and identify, you know, potentially as a trans girl. The notion that the sex that they were assigned on their birth certificate, you know, sets off the course of their life, and that, you know, in inherent in that are all of our understandings about their relationship to physical athletic skill, is a really sexist idea, right? There are plenty of boys who are frankly, you know, not that great at sports, and there are lots of girls, right, who are excellent. There are also lots of girls who aren't that great. But we this notion that mere gender identity is related to athletic skill is a sexist idea that I think we need to tackle more thoroughly, and that we certainly, in talking through the sexist ideology that is embedded within that, shouldn't target trans kids who, for the most part, are just trying to be a part of a team, are just trying to integrate on a sport that they love, and who, if parents could let go of the sexist idea that the sex assigned at birth is going to determine the outcome of their athletic skill, you know, could also maybe understand that what they're helping even their cisgender kids realize is that, right, athletic skill and capacity and the humanity of people can inhere in all people, irrespective of their gender identity.
Is the goal, Professor Sherrill, sex-integrated teams where both girls, boys, men, women can play on the same teams?
So I love this question. I've spent a lot of time thinking about this, and I appreciate you asking it. I think about this in a number of ways. So one thing that might be interesting for listeners to consider here is that although sex-segregated sports are widely used at the elite level, sex integration in youth sports is actually somewhat more common, right? But Title IX, in its implementation, there was a debate over whether or not full equality would be best realized through integrated or segregated teams. And the last time that we had that debate fully was in the 1970s. And at that time, the question looked very different. At least that's how I've come to think of it, right? Americans at the time were trying to grapple with how to strive towards gender equality in a system that had systematically excluded most women from athletic participation opportunities. So there were not training opportunities, there were not access to coaches, there were not access to the embodied experience of being an athlete. And so though interest groups in the 70s debated the question of whether integration would be necessary for full equality, back then, the conclusion that was reached among policymakers was that we had to have some way to take women from, you know, near full exclusion to something that got over that first hump. And I think we've gotten there, right? These first 50 years of Title IX have really changed not only opportunities, but also the relationship of women and girls to their bodies. And so the question about whether or not integration is a part of the future of Title IX, I think we need to be confident enough to re-engage that conversation with all that we've learned over the past 50 years. And I think that it's a false choice for us to imagine that the next step need be full integration, that we need to go from a system that has segregated boys and men from girls and women fully to one that lets down those sorts of competitive categories of organization and says, this is, you know, now we're going to have a free-for-all. But right now there are rules embedded in Title IX that say that girls are not actually allowed competitive tryouts for teams if there is a similar team for girls and women at their school or university. And this is a problem, right? Because in some contexts, the most athletically competitive opportunities might not necessarily be on the team that has been designated for girls and women. And there may be some girls or women athletes that say, you know, I do want to go and run with the boys. I do want to go and play hockey with the boys team. I do want to go and play baseball on the boys team. For those individuals who are ready to sort of cross these strictly segregated athletic categories, we have really restricted that possibility in many ways. And so I think we need to tackle that question first, because the frontier of giving women access to the best opportunities may very well require us to let go of our reliance on segregated athletics, at least in some ways and in some circumstances.
You've identified where Title IX has been successful. Where do you believe it's fallen short? How does it need to be improved?
You know, the enforcement capacity of the federal government is far greater than we have currently realized. So we have, at the collegiate level anyway, taken some steps to ensure that there is a fair amount of public information about the practices of college athletic departments. They have to report annually to the federal government a number of statistics about how they, the opportunities that they give to athletes on their campus, the amount of money that they spend on sports for men and women. But we have no similar transparent accounting strategy at the high school level. So there's a real lack of information on the one hand about what Title IX looks like, especially for youth and adolescent sports. At the same time, even what we do know about compliance with Title IX at the federal level indicates that these funding imbalances are significant, and that indeed the quality of opportunities at most campuses is far from equal. So we may have pursued equity, but we're far from full equality under Title IX. And in that sense, the federal government could take a number of much more aggressive strategies. It could require not only reporting, but could do much greater surveillance on the practices of institutions instead of as it is in the status quo, relying on athletes or coaches to pursue claims of discrimination in order for that kind of scrutiny to be placed on any athletic department.
So, Professor Cheryl, all week we've been hearing about the leak from the Supreme Court in regard to Roe v. Wade, a draft that would indicate that the court is about to overturn Roe v. Wade, if it is overturned. Do you see an impact on female athletes and Title IX?
This is a really important question, and I think many Americans have been trying to process this announcement of the leaked opinion and to make sense of it. And among the things that has been front of mind for me, especially in thinking about the meaning of a largely, although not fully, successful policy implementation effort over the past 50 years under Title IX, the ways in which we cannot have full equality for women without educational equality and reproductive autonomy. And that applies to athletes, that applies to students, that applies to American women who never go to college as well, that our full equality is mutually bound up in access to not only our civil rights, but our ability to make decisions for ourselves and about our bodies. And so if we are confronting a moment where the 50th anniversary of Title IX coincides with the drawback of reproductive rights for American women, I think that the story about Title IX, you know, needs to be told in some more complicated ways. And it seems very clear that we're confronting that possibility. But American women will not have full equality without the implementation of all of these laws simultaneously, right? Educational opportunity means much less if we don't have pay equity, if we don't find a way to have parental leave so that families can make decisions on their own accord. Title IX on its own can't do the work of reorganizing a society that doesn't treat women as fully equal citizens.
Do you believe, or do you have any evidence to indicate that those people who support Title IX also would support a woman's right to abortion?
Interesting. You know, scholars of public opinion are very interested in understanding how Americans think across different policy issues. And I think that's what social scientists would call an empirical question that we probably need to investigate more fully. You know, abortion has been so dominantly framed as a question of morality rather than as an issue of justice or equality for women, and that I would not be the least bit surprised to find that there is some division between and among Americans who may say, yes, I'm fully supportive of Title IX, but no, I actually believe that abortion rights, you know, are problematic or that they should be restricted. There's a lot of nuance to how Americans think about gendered issues that would make me I'd like to learn more about exactly how Americans think about those things. But I think that we will all do right in thinking about the long-term impacts of the women's movement over the past 50 years in its implementation, both in policy and law, but also in social movements, to see the connections between the issues that I was drawing out before, right? That full equality needs to happen across all sorts of different dimensions between and among American women and men, and for non-binary folks who don't identify with either gender category. We can't imagine that the Title IX is separate from these other issues.
Before we close, is there anything else you'd like to add?
Well, I think that attention to issues of gendered equality have perhaps never been more urgent as they are right now. And that these issues around gendered equality as I alluded to before, are not unrelated to racial justice, to disability justice, that as we think about the future of gender equality in the U.S., we're going to have to clearly remain vigilant to organized forces that are we are watching in real time, right? We are watching organized forces attempt to undermine not only our rights but also our commitments to a journey towards a fully realized democratically equal society that has been largely pursued, although, you know, not exclusively, but civil rights policy has really been key to getting us as far as we've come so far. And the notion that we may be at the high point of those rights and now on our way back down should be extremely alarming to Americans. And also, I think, a call to action, right? Because at least for now, we live in a democratic society that protects the rights of Americans to speak out on these issues, to demand more of their lawmakers, and to feel implicated in our struggle for a more equal society moving forward. So I don't want this to be the sort of the high point, right? I hope that this is a moment for reflection, maybe an inflection point towards a future that is better and more equal, but also more fully inclusive and non-discriminatory for all of us.
Thank you, Professor Sherrill.
You're welcome. It's a pleasure to talk with you.
That was Elizabeth Sherrill, Professor of History and Public Policy at the University of Massachusetts, Amherst. And that's all for today. We welcome your feedback and suggestions. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsberg of Wonderly. The show is produced by Allison Brody. Our engineer today is Michael Kidd. Thanks for listening, all. Be well. Stay safe. I'm Diane Rehm.